Welcome to Heart of Iowa, a weekly show on KHOI where individual reporters explore people and perspectives of interest to them. I'm today's host, Greta Anderson, and I've planned an hour of tribute to Nelson Mandela on his 95th birthday.
Whenever you talk about the Honorable Baba Mandela, Baba Matiba, he's a symbol of hope. He's a role model for a lot of young people in South Africa, including me. He's a symbol of peace, a symbol of unity.
Throughout the show, I will share bits of my conversation with two South African expatriates who live in Ames to provide first-person viewpoints of the great South African leader and the country's struggle for freedom. We also have tape from the Pacifica Archives of Mandela addressing the United Nations just months after his release, of Mandela addressing an audience of supporters in Oakland on the same tour, and of Desmond Tutu addressing All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena shortly after Mandela was elected the first president of the new South Africa in 1994. As a youth and later as a lawyer in Johannesburg, Nelson Mandela fought the apartheid system in South Africa. In the apartheid system, each inhabitant of this vast country was designated by law into one of four racial groups: native or black, white, colored or mixed race, and Asian, mainly Indian. And these four groups were forced to live in separate neighborhoods and towns. The majority native black residents were forced into so-called homelands or Bantustans and prohibited from voting or holding political office. They were forced to carry passbook IDs for travel into white neighborhoods where they would have to go to serve the white man. And they were frequently hassled, abused, and even killed by police. The apartheid system was introduced into South Africa in 1948, the very year that the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights was signed. In that year, 1948, Nelson Mandela was 30 years old. He was over 70 years old when, in 1990, he addressed the UN General Assembly about this continuing crime against humanity.
The tragedy is that what has created the need for this gathering and made it seem natural that we must gather in this historic meeting place is the fact of the continuing commission of a crime against humanity. How much better it would have been if we were meeting to celebrate a victory in hand, a dream fulfilled, the triumph of justice over a tyrannical past, the realization of the vision enshrined in the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It will forever remain an indelible blight on human history that the apartheid crime ever occurred. Future generations will surely ask, what error was made that this system established itself in the wake of the adoption of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights? It will forever remain an accusation and a challenge to all men and women of conscience that it took as long as it has before all of us stood up to say, enough is enough.
That was Nelson Mandela speaking to the UN just after his release from prison in 1990. In his 30s and 40s, Mandela had worked as a lawyer and as a leader of the African National Congress, or ANC, and in both those roles did everything he could to fight apartheid. These activities, of course, got him in trouble. He was sentenced to life imprisonment in 1962 on the charge of sabotage and conspiracy to overthrow the Afrikaner government of white Dutch ancestry. I go fight against apartheid. We got to fight against apartheid. You're in the middle. Other South African leaders, Stephen Biko, most prominent among them, had been murdered in prison. So this was not a safe place to be. Mandela spent 27 long years in jail in Pretoria, in the Pretoria dungeons, as he calls them in one speech. In the 1960s and 70s, while he was there in prison, nearly all the countries on the African continent were winning independence from colonial rule. Great democratic leaders like Julius Nyerere of Tanzania were emerging and promised a new kind of justice and prosperity for blacks. All the while, Mandela waited patiently for his moment and for his country's moment, serving as a source of hope and inspiration for the movement that grew up around him. Ames, Iowa resident Semakeleng Lebepi, who grew up in the township of Soweto, South Africa, remembers these years well, the 1960s and 70s. Here, she describes her high school days at the very school in Soweto where a few years later, a riot broke out and the resistance movement against the apartheid regime began to ratchet up. You're in a Milan. You build up your regime. Semakeleng, how old were you when you first heard of Nelson Mandela?
I heard of him when I was second year at high school, so 14, 15. I heard about him in a hush-hush way. Not for my parents, because that was a subject that we never touched at my house. We had a student Christian association, Christian in quotes, but when the advisor was not there, then that's when we talked about politics, and that's when I heard about Mandela. But it's something that I couldn't even approach my parents and ask about, because everything was like, you never say that, because if you say that, somebody might be a spy here and tell the police and you'll be detained. During my time, anyway, it was at the height of apartheid. The harsh conditions were there, but we sort of adapted and lived with it. We knew it was not right, so the only place that we could vent out our frustration was at school. But at the same time, the teachers were there to keep order, so we're not that rebellious. But, you know, like with every other kid, even American kids, once you reach a certain age, you know, at the age of 17, that's when we decided, myself included, that, you know, we're going to be open about expressing our feeling towards apartheid. And that's when formally the student associations were formed and we're part of it. We used to have Bible studies on a Friday. That was sort of mandatory. And I remember one time white priest was talking about how black people became. And he was saying that, you know, before there was a sea where everybody walked through, white people walked first, and they were all became white, and then the other races that are lighter, and then the black people were so slow that we just, the water was all gone, and then we just got our palms and our hands in the water. That's why our palms of our hands are the same as white people, you know, sort of the same color. At that time, the whole class just walked out And that was the beginning. And we went to the principal and said, no more religious studies. We are not going to do that. We are boycotting religious studies. And the white people out of our school if they are going to be teaching us that. So that was the beginning, I think, because I come from the school where the 1976 Soweto riot started. So I think our school was, you know, up front. And that's when it started. It was in 1971. When we started the student organization.
So you boycotted the white priest in 1971 and there were riots then later in 76?
Yeah, uh-huh. Only talk about justice. You're in a Milan. Handing down injustice.
What did you do in the 70s when you had graduated from high school and had this strong feeling, and yet the society around you was a dangerous place to be if you had those views?
Well, I think just in the 70s, things started, you know, the momentum started building up, and then 1976 was at the peak of it. And then, of course, at that time, I became a mother in 1975, which was, you know, something that I had to see if I could be part of that or not part of it, you know, protecting your little children. So as an adult at that time, I only participated in the boycotts when they increased the rent, for instance, you know, we'll go boycott that, and then the work situation will go, you know, for pay increase, we'll go demonstrate. So that's, but not too much because I was a mom as much as I wanted to, but I censored myself.
What did Nelson Mandela and his imprisonment mean to the group of people that you associated with?
I think it meant a lot of sacrifice. I mean, a lot of sacrifice. Some of us saw it a little bit because my first husband was also detained. He was a reporter. And I could, you know, empathize a lot how his family went through. You know, my ex-husband was only detained maybe for a month. But for him, for years, and his children never saw him, could never even visit, and the wife, even, I remember myself, I couldn't even go to see my ex-husband. So it was very difficult, so I empathized a lot with that family. They struggled a lot, suffered for our freedom.
That was Semakaleng Lebepi of Ames, formerly of Soweto. And this is Greta Anderson of KHOI. We are celebrating Nelson Mandela's 95th birthday by exploring first-person encounters with the history surrounding him. During the 1970s, Semakaleng was raising an infant boy. Meanwhile, my other guest, Sipho Ndlela, was born. Sipho grew up near Durban. I wanted to know how he, as a young black male, experienced apartheid.
It affected my mom and my dad and my elder brothers more than I did when I was younger. I was born in 1971. So when you talk about the 70s, for me, it's more like dreamland. But I would say when I started working in the city as a young garden boy, basically working for white people, cutting grass, trying to make money. You know, for us, it was not even easy to go to the white townships because you needed to have documentation. You needed a dorm pass, basically, to prove that you were there. I was talking to one of my friends recently. He says, wow, I remember the times when the white people would, when they wanted to see if their dog can bite, when they see a black person, they'll say, wow, let's see if our dog can bite. So they'll send a dog to go bite, you know, basically chase the black person and just bite them. And then they'll say, oh, wow, so this dog is good. Mm-hmm. That was their measure of success in terms of this dog is good. And he told me a story, actually, when he said one time they had bought sort of something that was powered by electricity. So they wanted to see exactly how much power it has. So they called this young black man to say, do you want to hold these wires? You want to see if this thing really worked? And the next minute he was on the floor. They say, yes, it does work, because he was shocked by electricity. So those things, I did not directly experience it, but a lot of my colleagues did. But the worst nightmare for me I had in terms of update was just the brutality from the police. When I upgraded myself and worked at, moved away from being a garden boy to working at a grocery shop called OK Bazaars, similar to Hy-Vee basically, you would have to take a train there. So from time to time, there will be police, white police and black police, that will be patrolling from time to time. So if they wanted to come by and just punch you in the face or just slap you, you just have to say, sorry, boss, you know, as a way to, as a way. So, and they'll do that once in a while. So they'll just come and punch you. So you'll just say, I'm sorry, boss, as if you did something. But you knew if you did not say sorry, another punch was coming your way. So I've experienced that. I did experience that, unfortunately. But it's not compared to what my parents experienced. They went through much more difficulties. But experiencing riots during after Mrs. Mwenga passed away was the worst. So there were times, unfortunately, where you could not sleep at home. You had to go hide in the forest because you didn't know who was going to come in your house knocking to ask for boys to be questioned as for their involvement in the struggle. I was raised in a very religious family. I was not politically active at any point in my life when I was young because my mom wanted to always protect us from those. But when it was time when the police were attacking, they didn't discriminate whether you were religious or not. As long as you are a man, you are capable of being an enemy of the state. So you'll be attacked. If you're unlucky, you'll be killed. A lot of young people died. I know of some friends that passed away. A lot of young men had to run away and cross the countries to Swaziland, Zimbabwe. You know, some of them went as far as Russia, you know, to try and run away from what was happening in South Africa.
My son is about his age, and I brought him here in 1986. So when he first came here, we lived at UV apartments. And, you know, university apartments, they're always police. I just didn't understand why every time he would come inside the house, sweating, his eyes so wide open. And then finally I asked him, I thought other kids were making fun of him or something. And then when I asked him, I said, what's going on? Could you tell me? The South African police sent these police to be after me. And then he sat down and explained to me that, you know, whenever you see a police car, how you have to walk against the wall or gate, and then just the nearest gate to just walk in and walk into the house as if it's your own home. During the 1976 riots, I was there. That was a time when, you know, whenever people sing on television that, you know, we say, power, power to the people. A young kid, maybe 4, 5, 6, this young kid thought that when you see the hippo, the police car, you're supposed to be power. And then all of us, you know, when we see the hippo, you just run inside the house, close as if there's nobody. And the little child was left there. And they just shot him on the head. Those are the worst nightmares. It took me a long time to come to terms that, you know, I am safe here.
It is 2013 in the United States, and a white man has just been exonerated for shooting a black man who looked suspicious to him. I happened to meet with Sipho and Semakoleng the day after the Trayvon Martin verdict. When I asked their responses to it, Sipho told me an interesting story. Here's what happened to him the very night the jury reached its decision. Just so you know, this story involves driving while black and public urination.
As I was driving down from Welsh, I noticed that the cop was following me. I started driving slowly because I was like, oh, he's going to stop me. He must be thinking I'm drunk or something. Luckily, I don't drink alcohol, so I didn't have to worry about anything. So as I'm driving through Friday Hall, and I'm seeing a white couple that were peeing behind the wall at Friday Hall, and I was like, oh, those people are peeing there. I was like, I wonder what's going to happen. You know, he was pulling his zippers. I was like, wow, that's interesting. I want to see if this cop is going to arrest them or anything. And no. But I noticed that he was still following me. And I was like, that's interesting. So I drove into one of the buildings on campus. Then he pulled me and asked me, what are you doing here? So I explained what I was doing there. He asked me to prove that I'm allowed to be there. So I showed him. I happened to be on a phone with a friend at that time. So And he could hear every conversation. So I remember it saying, you know what, I'm glad you did not resist or anything. You just spoke softly. So that adds to the fear. So although I knew he was following me, but I knew that whatever I do, I have to relax. I should not panic. Although I was panicking. So the memories of having cops follow you or something is unfortunate. When we were young, when you saw a cop, no matter what was happening, you run away. Even up to today, when I go to South Africa, when I see a cop, I shiver. Imagine then if something like this happens here in the U.S. where this young man was shot to death and all of a sudden the person who committed a crime, he said, you're not guilty. It is very difficult to swallow. It is very difficult to swallow.
My first reaction was like, you know, if I was Trayvon's mom, I would just go there in the neighborhood, put my hoodie on and sit there like we used to do in South Africa. My presence would be felt. I would just sit there and the police would have to remove me. I'll say, I am grieving my son and this is where I'm going to grieve my son, where he was killed. I just feel, you know, when I felt that, I just said, this is what I would do. Justice is not there. So we are to fight, 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 fight against apartheid. That man got to fight, 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 fight against apartheid. Across the border, we shoot off the children. Across the border,
this is KHOY Community Radio. We are talking with two South African expatriates about Nelson Mandela apartheid and, as it so happened, the Trayvon Martin verdict. What year did you come here to the United States?
July 22nd, 1982. I know that because it was my birthday.
That's pretty close to Nelson Mandela's birthday. Uh-huh. And right around the time you came to the U.S., the worldwide movement against apartheid was building.
Yeah, I think that was the best time to come here because it was good to be able to speak up. In fact, I learned more about South African politics when I was here in the States because at home there was nothing. We couldn't read the newspaper. We didn't have newspapers. We couldn't read anything about the political prisoners. Maybe a snippet there, you know, just so-and-so has been detained. And then maybe one paragraph about how he died in jail, slipping on a piece of soap and cracked his head and died, which was, you know, every time I see a piece of soap in my shower, I was like, how can anyone die like that, you know? So those were the little things, nothing much in the news, little things, you know, it gave us a chance to go out and demonstrate if somebody dies in jail. But coming here, it was an eye-opener for myself also, just starting to read and realizing, and then putting pieces together. I remember when they were talking about the passbook, the reference book, boycotts, the ID, and I was part of it, but I didn't know. I remember my mom, you know, asking me to put this book in a pillow. We used to make our own dolls, you know, from a pillow stuffed. So we stuffed those things and stitched. It didn't make sense to me. I was like, why is my mom making us put this book in here? And it was because, you know, there were going to be some ANC people coming in and saying that let's go burn those passbooks. And then my mom wanted to protect my dad so that he didn't have his passbook. So that was inside one of our homemade dolls.
As a college DJ in the 80s, I spun this special AKA song, as well as the Peter Tosh song we heard earlier, almost every week on my radio show. I was actually quite sheltered when I arrived at college, something I was certainly seeking to change. But when I came across a rally on the quad introducing to me this strange and powerful word, apartheid, and the even more powerful word, divestment, I was spellbound. I returned to those rallies day after day, by myself, too shy to make friends there, really, and sometimes skipping my classes, really just wanting to be a number in the crowd. This is how Nelson Mandela touched my life. In 1986, Stanford made its first move to divest from Motorola, which was providing hardware to the South African military. Other divestment actions followed. You are listening to KHOI's special 95th birthday tribute to the great South African leader, Nelson Mandela. In 1990, after 27 years of imprisonment, Nelson Mandela was freed by the Afrikaner white government under William F. de Klerk. That year, he visited the U.S. to address the United Nations. His short speaking tour concluded with this address to a huge crowd of supporters at Oakland Coliseum. Pacifica Radio, of which KHOI is an affiliate, was there to record it.
On my release from jail last February the 11th, we walked out of the prison gates to a tumultuous and joyous welcome. Our people, in their multitudes, had come from all corners of South Africa to receive us back into a world of struggle. The heaven rang with their chants of joy. 10 days ago, my delegation, my wife, and I stepped on the soil of this United States. Once more, we were received with overwhelming attributes of friendship and solidarity. This experience has been repeated in every city we have visited. We have witnessed support for the fight against apartheid and for human liberty and peace in South Africa. It is clear beyond any reasonable doubt that the unbanning of our organization came as a result of the pressures exerted upon the apartheid regime by yourselves. By yourselves, as part of the international community, and by the determined actions of our struggling people, you have inspired us beyond imagination. on behalf of the African National Congress and its entire membership, we thank you for your solidarity. It is a great honor for us because, in fact, it is a tribute to the fighting spirit of our people. We say it is a tribute to the fighting spirit of our people who are also your people. We know that this rally was made possible by the unity in action of all sectors of this community. Today in South Africa, the same spirit has begun to break down the walls of apartheid. There are many obstacles ahead of us. Both overt and covert, many apartheid laws are still on the statute book. The freedom to conduct a political organization is still threatened by the state and right-wing vigilantes. Our schools are still segregated and inferior. Medical services are inadequate. Unemployment is high. Housing is scarce. And the masses of our people are still without land. It is our responsibility as the National Liberation Movement to take action for change. Our movement is now expected, after 3 decades of illegality, to operate efficiently. The task ahead is daunting, but our resolve is strong. In addition, our people are determined to fight for liberty until victory is achieved. The people's campaigns, carried out with amazing courage and great sacrifice, have pushed the government to concede the legal space for a widened political participation. We are at a crucial historical juncture. We cannot turn back. We shall not turn back. We need your support for this final stage. Now, more than ever, we call on you to redouble your efforts. We have spoken elsewhere of the inspired actions of great Americans, such as Martin Luther King Jr. Malcolm X, Fannie Lou Hamer, John Brown, and many others. Together, we must rekindle the spirit of strength and beauty and dispatch racism once and for all from human society. We are committed to the establishment of a united, non-racial, non-sexist, democratic South Africa. We demand one person, one vote on a common non-racial voter's roll. Our people demand democracy. Our country, which continues to bleed and suffer pain, needs democracy. Our country stands on the threshold of fundamental change, but we still have a long road to travel before reaching our destination, freedom. As long as apartheid is in place, we appeal to you to maintain sanctions.
That was Nelson Mandela in 1990 speaking to an audience in Oakland Coliseum. And this is KHOI Community Radio with a special 95th birthday tribute to the great leader. As Mandela emphasizes in his speech, his release did not mean the immediate end of apartheid. For the next 4 years, he negotiated intensely with the Afrikaner government of South Africa for change. In 1994, the first national elections in which blacks could vote were held. Here is Archbishop Desmond Tutu, a major proponent, along with Nelson Mandela, of nonviolent resistance to the evil of apartheid, describing to All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena the change that occurred that allowed this election to take place.
Please, we mustn't forget that it is a great victory. We mustn't forget the viciousness that was apartheid. Because only just a short 4 or 5 years ago, we could not walk on God's beaches because they were segregated beaches. And when we were protesting against that foul law, the police were ready then, as they said, to use even live ammunition to get us to move away. To use live ammunition to support, defend something so utterly indefensible. We mustn't forget that. So we were in real trouble. And you prayed us out of that trouble. You supported us out of that trouble. You remember that lovely story with Elisha, the prophet, surrounded by the armies of the king. And his servant, totally apprehensive, is frightened. And Elisha says to God, open his eyes so that he may see. And God opens the servant's eyes. And when he sees God's host surrounding them, and he learns, therefore, that those for us are many, many times more than those against us. And we experienced that. In the dark days of apartheid, you were their friends. And it is so wonderfully appropriate that we can be here to celebrate with you. The psalmist somewhere says, as he exults over God, you are a God who works wonders. You are a God who works miracles. Now we in South Africa can say amen to that. Because as we were approaching this epoch-making election, we were gritting our teeth, fearful of the violence that was going to be happening because a major political party, the Inkatha Freedom Party, led by Chief Buthelezi, had said it was boycotting the elections. And you know the violence and the death that had already resulted because of the rivalry between this Inkatha party and the ANC. And then, this God who works miracles, this wonder-working God, did his stuff. And out of the blue, at the proverbial 11th hour, the Inkatha Freedom Party said we were going to participate in the elections. And almost as if someone was turning on or turning off the violence reduced quite dramatically. And then the election happened. And we were still scared that people would be intimidated. There were the bomb blasts just before. But instead, people poured out in their millions. And maybe it was just as well we aren't as efficient as you. Because they then had to stand in those long lines for hours on end. John, my media secretary, says there is a new status symbol in South Africa. People say, oh, you know, I stood for 2 hours before I could vote. And somebody says, oh, that's nothing. I stood there for 5 hours. And somebody else does something else. But it was actually an incredible thing because South Africans suddenly discovered one another as they stood in those queues, sharing food, talking to one another, black and white, suddenly made a profound scientific discovery. They discovered that they were South Africans together. We had been trying to tell them.
I asked my guests, Sifo Ndeleli and Semakaleng Lebepe Mazur, whether they participated in this historic event. Sifo, it turns out, was in the States, studying at ISU. A voting station for South Africans had been made available in Chicago. He had a choice: take the final exam of a very difficult organic chemistry course, or attempt to travel with his friends to Chicago.
I went and asked my professor. She was one of the good professors. I love her to death. She's an amazing organic chemistry professor. Amazing. I went and asked her. She gave me a choice. Do you want to take my exam or go vote? I said, I want to take your exam. So my friends drove there, but their car broke down halfway. They never voted. So I'm like, so I was thinking, I said, you know what? I made a good choice. Unfortunately, I wanted to. But I knew if I didn't go, I was going to fail that class. But she was an excellent professor, but very tough at the same time.
I voted. I happened to be doing my postdoc timely. I went there in 93 and I was there in 94. And thought I would never vote in South Africa. And my son was able to vote too. And I remember being in that booth. All of a sudden, I couldn't see. And then I didn't realize that I was crying. It took me a while to be in that booth. I was just crying. I was so overwhelmed with joy. It was the most wonderful day. I remember how I woke up at 4:30 a.m. to stand in line, and Bob and the kids brought me my breakfast, standing there in the queue, waiting to vote. That was the most wonderful day. I won't forget that day. Because I had said, you know, when things were bad in South Africa, before I left 82, I never thought I would reach the age of 50. So when I reached my 50th, 10, 11 years ago, I had a party because I never thought I would be alive. So voting in South Africa was the best thing ever for me. I'll never forget that. I'll never get those emotions.
An election for you normally would be a secular event, a political event. It turned out for us to be a spiritual event. It became a religious mountaintop transfiguration experience. South Africans walked into the polling booth one kind of person and emerged on the other side a different kind of person. They walked in carrying, if they were white, a heavy burden of guilt, and they emerged on the other side. They were surprised. This huge weight of guilt had been lifted. They were free. And black people walked in and emerged on the other side and suddenly discovered that the dignity that had been denied them, that had been trodden underfoot for so long, had been restored. You know, God 2,000 years ago made a cross on a ballot box, choosing to give us Jesus, this Jesus who then, in this act of the cross, produced a new people. Through this, the cross that God made, reconciliation was effected. And we, on the 27th of April, made our cross and discovered that this cross had this incredible capacity to make us new people. That this cross helped to make us reconciled to one another. And at the end of this process, incredibly, there was no gloating. No, I mean, the ANC didn't say we had won this enormous victory. Incredible. I don't know why it didn't happen, except that you were praying. George sent us a message and said, we're praying here in All Saints for your election. And you prayed. And God heard. And this miracle working God did his stuff again. And now we have a government of national unity. Mr. de Klerk, who must for always be commended for the courage he had shown in February 1990, has shown a remarkable graciousness in taking not just second fiddle, he is now third fiddle. Now that is actually something quite remarkable. But then you see, I'm not boasting. We are remarkable people in South Africa. And we are saying this people want to be healed. These people have all been traumatized by apartheid. And you, friends, have still got an important role to play. Pray us into healing, into becoming truly one. We now have a new flag. And we are all suddenly so patriotic. We love our flag. We have, in fact, now three national anthems. I sang the Afrikaans one for the very first time in my life. But I sang it, and it seemed so right to sing it. So we sing Nkosi Sikelele, Morena Buluka Setšhaba, the one that you sang so beautifully, and the Afrikaans one. I wept at 2 points when they elected Mandela president, and then at the inauguration, when the flypast happened, for some extraordinary reason, almost all of us, certainly in the black community, suddenly looked up at these machines that used to be killing machines for us, machines that we used to shake our clenched fist at. When they went past, to salute Mandela as the new commander-in-chief. Almost as if somebody touched a button which affected all of us. We said, hey, these are now ours. We are one people of different cultures and races, of different faiths, but we are now one people. And we're going to make it.
We just heard a speech given by Archbishop Desmond Tutu on the epoch-making election of Nelson Mandela to the South African presidency in 1994. Mandela held the presidency for 4 years and established a progressive agenda with women in high offices, protections for gays and lesbians, and most important, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that, rather than punish the white perpetrators of state violence, allowed them to publicly apologize and allowed blacks to publicly testify about their experiences under apartheid. Then, in 1999, Mandela deliberately left this high office so that leadership could be passed on to the next generation. After all, he was 80 years old. He was born in 1918, 11 years before Martin Luther King Jr. And this Thursday, July 18th, he will be 95 years old. Here is Ames resident Semakaleng Lebepi Mazur talking about Mandela's legacy. What did you think of Nelson Mandela's presidency?
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, I think I felt so much at peace. He is so forgiving. When he came out, you know, he didn't have that animosity that we had against white people. He brought peace. I felt at peace with myself. I mean, even there are some other people who still had hatred, racial hatred. He sort of diffused it. For a while. And also people expected a lot from him, but he couldn't do. I think if he came out of jail much younger, he would have accomplished a lot of things because he's the president for the people, not for himself, unlike what we have right now that, you know, they are there for themselves, not for the people. But he's a good leader in that, you know, he didn't want to stay. He said, I'll come out, serve 4 years, and be out so that there could be other leaders coming in.
So what have been your thoughts in these last few weeks when we've heard about Nelson Mandela's failing health and inevitability of his death?
Well, it's sad, but at the same time, I think, you know, the South African people should let go. I know it's hard, but we know that's our ultimate, and he has done a lot for everybody. He's such a selfish person. And I think if there is heaven, he's one person who's going to go marching in heaven, and maybe the angels are waiting for him. Our ancestors are there waiting for him to accept him.
You have been listening to a special tribute to Nelson Mandela on his 95th birthday. My guests today were Semakaleng Lebepi Mazur and Sifo Ndeleli, both of Ames. Sincere thanks to both of them for spending their time with me. We heard clips from speeches by Nelson Mandela and Archbishop Desmond Tutu made available by Pacifica Archives. This show is posted online at our website, khoifm.org. under the show heading Heart of Iowa. As always, your listenership is what makes our work worthwhile. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.